Do you know someone who's been diagnosed with cancer? I'd be surprised if you didn't. Or maybe you yourself have faced a cancer diagnosis. It has touched or even devastated many of us, and that's why so many researchers are hell-bent on eradicating it. I'd love your views on treatment for cancer. How have you seen that change over the years in your life? You can comment on our Facebook page. This week, the Victorian Comprehensive Cancer Centre has been hosting a major conference, and Professor Doug Hanahan is a key speaker. He co-authored a groundbreaking paper, which was a catalyst for many new forms of cancer detection and treatment. Doug, welcome to Life Matters.
Oh, thank you. Glad to be here.
Now, the paper you worked on, The Hallmarks of Cancer, has been hugely influential. Tell us what we thought cancer was then and how your paper changed that.
Well, obviously, a major goal of cancer research has been to understand the mechanisms of the disease, because through understanding mechanisms, we can maybe think about better ways to treat it, because as you mentioned, treatments are often not what we would desire. And this hallmarks concept really put together the notion that tumors are not simple things. They are outlaw organs, and that they have a number of capabilities which allow them to grow expansively. And essentially, this concept crystallizes the notion that cancer requires a series of distinct capabilities, much like any kind of an engine that has different parts, and the parts work together, in this case, for the evil purpose of cancer. And so this concept has helped us to think about differing ways to potentially, you know, rethink the war on cancer.
So before then, had we been a bit in the dark about what differentiated cancer cells from normal cells, how one became the other?
Well, there was a lot of information out there and about these different characteristics, but no one had put them together into a holistic sense of thinking about this outlaw organ, and that all of these things we'd observed really fit together.
And so you and your co-authors distilled those hallmarks into a few key things. Can you tell us briefly what they were?
Well, I can mention a few of them without going on, but obviously cancer is an expansive disease. And so we know that cancers have, it's very much like a car. There's an accelerator that causes the cells to divide. The braking systems that normally switch off cell division and cell growth are disabled. Mechanisms to protect the organism from aberrant cells, such as programmed cell death, are inactivated. There are ways to evade the attention of the immune system. These are all distinct capabilities that tumors develop in order to grow expansively.
And if we jump in our time machines and look at the history of how we understand cancer, if we go back to, say, the 50s, was there a feeling that cancer was one big problem and we had to solve it as one big problem?
Yeah, there certainly was. It was a much simpler view of cancer, and that if we could simply block one aberration in cancer, we could potentially have major impact. And the whole notion of targeted therapies, we were so excited about its final realization in the clinic. But the problem has been that's disappointing, because in general, cancers are like ISIS. You hit them hard, they retract, but then they come back with resistance. And that's been the sobering reality, that there's no magic bullets. And therefore, we really are now thinking about a new war plan for cancer that involves really attacking by air, by land, and by sea. That maybe then, if we hit the cancer in these different capabilities in effective ways, that maybe then we can really keep cancer in check.
And with the ISIS parallel, we stop it at the source, but we also resist the take-up by the population.
That's correct, yeah.
So, Doug Hanahan, in 2011, you did a follow-up article to the Hallmarks of Cancer paper, and you and your team included some more elements. How much further do you think that process will go? Will we just keep discovering hallmarks?
Well, there's some provisional hallmarks on the horizon, but right now there's nothing that appears to be broadly applicable across, you know, most forms of human cancer. There are things that are associated with particular forms of cancer that are in addition to these eight hallmarks. But right now, it's unclear. But there's no obvious candidates to be general hallmarks.
Now, that paper, that original paper, was the most cited article ever in Cell magazine, where it was originally published. So you and your team are basically the Rolling Stones of cancer research. How does that go down as a researcher? Do you think about that?
Well, yeah, it was a remarkable collaboration, actually an intellectual collaboration with Robert Weinberg, who's a professor at MIT. And we actually met up at a conference in Hawaii and spent the day together visiting a dormant volcano and started talking about, well, how do we think about this daunting diversity of cancer? And these ideas started to crystallize. We thought maybe it was the hypoxia of going up to 3,000 meters. But you know, at the time, we thought, well, this is kind of interesting. Maybe we should try to write this up. But we had no sense that it would resonate through time. So it was really quite a surprising result that it really did crystallize in the minds of many people in an enduring fashion. But this was completely unexpected to us. And so it is obviously very satisfying.
We're speaking with Professor Doug Hanahan. He's currently the director of the Swiss Institute for Experimental Cancer Research and co-author of the groundbreaking Hallmarks of Cancer paper. And I'm wondering if you have seen treatment for cancer change over the years in your life, your family, your experience. You can leave a comment on our Facebook page. We're also joined by Associate Professor Kate Burberry. She's a clinician and researcher at the Peter MacCallum Cancer Centre, where she takes cutting-edge therapies into her clinic. Kate, welcome to Life Matters.
My pleasure to be here, Helen.
What sparked your interest in cancer research?
Oh, it's a great question. You know, I think there's a million reasons why we enter into this space, and it's truly a vocation. And I think listening to Doug, you can see that it is a vocation for all of us. And for us that work in the space with patients, really Doug's work and people off the back of it's been transformative. You know, prior to understanding those deprogramming pathways, we were really throwing sort of non-specific weed killers at patients, for want of a better description, hoping that we could, you know, disintegrate these tumour cells that Doug so eloquently described. But by unpackaging where things go wrong, we've actually been able to be far more targeted in our approach and spare the normal tissue. But as Doug said, actually get into the mechanics of what's driving these cells to not only survive but proliferate and then invade. And it's been transformative in terms of the way we manage our patients.
Sounds like for both of you, it's a really interesting space in which to work. There's the abstract question, the problem of cancer and how it works, and that's great to get your teeth into. But obviously the motivation of being able to help people is huge too.
Oh, it's the most powerful trigger for all of us. You know, making a difference for people is really why we do it. And I suppose for us, opening this black box for opportunities has expanded in front of our eyes. And it's not just for the solid tumours. Doug and I were speaking earlier. It's not just about those solid tumours that were resistant to chemotherapy, but it's actually opened the doors for other areas that didn't have therapies available for them. So it's been transformative in so many ways.
Doug, was there a moment early on in your career where you thought, cancer, that's where I'd like to put my energies?
Well, yeah, I was in the mid-80s, I developed a model of cancer. And I at the time, I didn't, you know, I thought this might be interesting to make a model system for tumors. This was in mice. But when we started studying, so these were mice that are heritably prone to develop cancer. And I thought, okay, great, it'll make a tumor. But then we began to study them, and we saw that much like in human patients, the cancers do not arise instantaneously. They come up as the mice age. They go through stepwise transformations to becoming increasingly aberrant. And then I started thinking, you know, this is interesting. I mean, maybe we could really learn things about the mechanisms by which cancers develop and progress to highly malignant states. And then now the whole frontier, which is alluded to, is that we can understand the failures of drugs. And that's really, really an interesting space now to say, okay, we've hit them with a targeted therapy that we thought should be curative and it's not, but we can understand how they develop resistance. And that's interesting. It's important. It tells us about our biology, but it also gives us new opportunities to provide additional therapies that counteract that resistance. So it's a very interesting disease, you know, despite the fact that it's a horrible disease if you suffer from it. But intellectually, it's a really interesting window into our biology.
Let's talk about some of the improvements that we've seen in treatments, especially. Kate, you specialise in hematology. Mm. What impact has been made in terms of advances in treatment and detection?
Mm. I think to describe it, you've really got to go through the spectrum. And so there's one disorder that I spent a lot of time looking after called chronic myeloid leukemia. And it's really the trailblazer in terms of understanding the programming mechanisms. And they unpackaged a genetic mutation that drives it. Prior to knowing that, it was universally fatal. People died within 2 to 5 years, and that's devastating. And our therapies were palliative at best. Now we have a magic bullet. It's a designer drug that targets that genetic mutation, and people are leading normal lives. And in fact, if you look at patients with CML now, they're living longer than their age match equivalents without the disorder. And that's really, really powerful. And that's transcended into other areas as well. There are other disorders that have specific mutations that allow us to make these designer drugs. But as Doug was alluding to, it's a little bit like roadblocks. And these tumour cells are sort of self-surviving beasts. And if you think about the wonderful Darwin theory, they evolve. And so, but what it's done is it's opened our eyes. So we can start by looking at specific mutations or specific aberrations and make these designer drugs, but more importantly, then understand how we can overcome those roadblocks. And then we can truly find ways to stop cancer dead in its tracks.
Are we starting to think differently about the idea of curing cancer too? Are we thinking more about extending people's lives and keeping that cancer managed?
Absolutely. And turning tumours or cancers into a chronic disorder. You know, don't want to belittle it and describe it like diabetes or rheumatoid arthritis, but that's in essence what we're doing. We're hoping to re-establish normality in patients' lives and allowing them to lead normal lives with these targeted therapies.
So, Doug, your paper has had a particular impact on melanoma treatment, and in Australia we prick up our ears whenever anyone says melanoma. Can you tell me more about particularly what we're starting to understand about the role of the immune system in relation to melanoma?
Well, obviously, yeah, one of the, you know, the eighth hallmark is the notion that we now appreciate that the immune system recognizes cancers and attempts to attack them. But what we see in symptomatic disease are cancers that have figured out how to evade and stay under the radar of the immune system. And that this is a general principle, and this has been real, and this came about through decades of study of the regulation of immune cells, because the immune system is meant to be a strike force that's activated, comes in, fights an infection, heals a wound, and then goes away. Because if it doesn't go away, you have autoimmunity like diabetes, rheumatoid arthritis, which are also devastating disease. So the immune system is supposed to shut itself off, and cancers figure out how to shut off the immune system. But now this Nobel Prize-winning discovery and others have shown us how we can circumvent the cancer's ability to shut off the immune system. And so this has been really transformative. And for example, in melanoma now, where about half of patients with metastatic melanoma, which used to be a lethal disease, have substantial lifespan, and they may be cured. And this is really, really remarkable because previously we had a designer drug that was targeting the proliferative hallmark that we thought was going to be transformative. Because it targeted this essential signal to proliferate. And that drug works, but it only works transiently, and then resistance develops. And that's been this this recurring result that you get response and then resistance. Now, even with immunotherapy, we're starting to see resistance developing in some patients. So again, we're going to have to come in with other treatments by air, by land, and by sea. But obviously, immunotherapy has become now a fourth pillar of cancer therapy, and it's a huge, huge development. And obviously, our review did not crystallize this. But it just helped crystallize the appreciation of it.
And Kate, you've been interested in immunotherapies too. Is there something you can tell us about advances we're making here?
Oh, as Doug alluded to, we're sort of harnessing our own immune system to be an in-house containment of these tumours, and that's been revolutionary in blood tumours. We've got a number of immunotherapies now in the space, right through from checkpoint inhibitors that Doug was alluding to, through to what we call CAR T cells that a lot of people have heard about, where we're actually taking T cells to not only identify but also induce an immune response to these cells, and it's really exciting.
And our survival rates in Australia aren't bad, are they?
No, and in fact there's been some recent release of figures that we discussed over at the meeting, and it's really exciting to know that Australia is right up there in the world, and and leading the way in terms of outcomes, because that's what matters to patients. It matters to patients that they survive. It matters to patients that they achieve these wonderful responses. And we're leading the world in the top 5 to 7 different tumours that they've looked at.
Though those survival rates do drop once we get outside the major cities, don't they?
Yeah, they do.
What might help change that?
Oh, look, it's a really powerful strategy that we're very invested in, and we're trying to scale that access and overcome the disparities in Australia. Partnerships with the regional centres is really important. Allowing access to cutting-edge diagnostics and therapeutics through clinical trials is the first point for that. And we're starting to scale a specific model, which we call the teletrial model. And what it does is enables patients, no matter what cancer they've got, where they live, access to these cutting-edge therapies. And we know that is the first step to allowing them access to these wonderful agents that Doug's alluded to.
And Kate, on the access to therapies issue, tell me about combination therapies and what impact they're having.
Yeah, so I think, you know, one of the things that Doug was alluding to in terms of attacking it by air, land and sea is this sort of dynamic sequencing. And we know that every therapy we use comes with an armamentarium of side effects and toxicity. So using combination therapies can be very powerful for two ways. One, attacking from multimodality, but also hopefully alleviating side effects by minimising the toxicity that you need to do. So by this sort of dynamic sequencing, you can actually have effective therapy with less side effects, which is really, really important. I often sort of describe myself as a supportive care physician, because it's not about delivering the therapy, it's actually about getting through the therapy so that they can benefit from it. It's a really important part of what we do.
It sounds like such a nimble disease, you have to have a nimble response.
Yeah.
Doug, we hear a lot about personalised cancer medicine. What do we mean by this, and what kind of impact could that have on helping people live longer, better lives?
Well, the underlying this simplicity of these hallmarks concept is the fact that there's incredible diversity in the mechanisms by which these acquired capabilities can be conveyed upon a tumor. And what that means then is that because you have to interfere with the precise mechanism that's operative, not with the general concept. And so what we're finding now is that even tumors of the same type, like lung cancer, we used to think that some smoking-induced lung cancer was one disease. Well, it turns out it's 10 or 15 diseases because they have differing aberrations in them and differing changes in the characteristics of their outlaw organ. And we need to understand those in each patient in order to tailor their therapy, because we have an armamentarium of drugs, including immunotherapy, but we now are learning that they might work in one subtype of a tumor and not another. And so the ability to interrogate a patient's individual tumor and say, okay, you have some vulnerabilities to these drugs, but not those drugs. And so that's the whole notion of precision medicine, or also called personalized medicine, where we can really begin to fine-tune therapies based on the particular way that that tumor has acquired these hallmark capabilities.
And on a population level, that sounds hugely encouraging, but on a personal level, many people are hearing that clock just go tick, tick, tick above their heads. Doug, are you excited about the next 5 or so years of cancer research?
Oh, yeah, I think we're just in a remarkable time now where we're beginning to think, as Kay was saying, not only because about how to really fight this war in a smarter way and by sequencing to minimize toxicity and to avoid or to circumvent resistance. I mean, it's a very exciting time because we have so much knowledge, we have powerful tools to interrogate tumors and an increasing repertoire of drugs to aim at them. And we just have to figure out how to do it, limit toxicity, and avoid resistance. So it's a very exciting frontier.
And Kate, what about you? What do you hope to be able to say to people in 3, 5, 10 years that come to your waiting room?
Look, I think expanding on what Doug said really is there's opportunity and hope. And so when patients come to meet you, we don't even talk about the word of cure. We talk about opportunity, that, you know, we have an expanded repertoire in our armamentarium, as Doug alluded to. And this is just the start of a journey. And that's our role, is to navigate them through that journey.
Do you want to blue sky some potential treatments we might start to see in the next few years?
Oh, I think it's expanding in front of our eyes. And you know, there were disorders that we had no therapies for that now we do. So we would be here for the next hour talking to you about what they look like. But I think, you know, from immunotherapies to targeted therapies to molecular therapies, and it's a really exciting space to be a part of.
And there's been a massive shift, hasn't there, just in the culture of medical care around cancer. I guess going back 10 or 20 years, it used to be seen as a death sentence, and people would know that they were probably going to have very brief conversations with their therapists and depressing ones. But now it's really different, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. It's all about instilling opportunity and hope. And also I think that we've now expanded more to a multidisciplinary approach to care. And so bringing in all of the subspecialties and the allied health professionals is a really important part of opening that up. So when we look after these people and their families, it's about their nutrition, their exercise, being part of their work, being part of their life. And so it's changed the narrative. It's no longer about, oh no, I've got cancer, I now have to have chemotherapy. It's about how do we keep you in the normality of the world that matters to you.
And Doug, what about the idea of a cure? Is it a pipe dream or something you're still working towards?
Well, I think because of this incredible diversity and complexity and the Darwinian evolution that Kay mentioned, I think the notion of a cure for cancer is naive. But really, we have to think in a much more specific manner. Cancer is hundreds of diseases, dozens of subtypes, and incredible variability. So we need to, but we can create potentially cancer without disease, where we can keep it in check. And so I think that maybe in some cases we'll cure cancer, but if in other cases we can produce cancer without disease, people live out their lives normally, because we can keep keep it under control. And I think that's an achievable goal for a number of human cancers. But some are very, very tough. So we've got a long way to go.
I just have this image of a little futile cancer waving its puny fist inside a cage in someone's body. I hope we get there soon. Thank you so much, both of you, for coming on to Life Matters
today. Okay, thank you.
Professor Doug Hanahan is the director of the Swiss Institute for Experimental Cancer Research, co-author of the groundbreaking paper, The Hallmarks of Cancer. And Associate Professor Kate Burberry is a clinician and researcher at the Peter MacCallum Cancer Centre in Melbourne. You're listening to Life Matters here with me, Hilary Harper, and you, Michael McKenzie.
And we asked overnight on Facebook, over your life, how have you seen treatment for cancer change? And people have been Facebooking and texting. Hilary says, someone on text, I'm 47. I have advanced breast cancer in my lungs 15 years after my first bout. 15 years ago, this diagnosis had a life expectancy of 2 years. I'm now really well, and 2 years into the diagnosis, realise that my life expectancy is probably the same as anyone else. Thank you, thank you, thank you to those researchers. Another person, Sue, says 50 years ago, my dad, age 41, was diagnosed with glioblastoma multiforme, a brain tumour stroke cancer. He lived 6 months after diagnosis. Several years ago, I visited the Danny Thomas Centre at St. Jude's Hospital in Memphis, Tennessee. It was amazing to see the wonderful success treatments available now and how many have benefited. Just wonderful. Annie writes for New South Wales, early detection is amazing. My brother and I both had tests and surgery without feeling lumps or pain, bowel and breast respectively. It was weird, she says, to the point where you wonder if you really had it. And
wow.
But early detection.
Yep.
And I'll read this one too from Maxine. Over time, treatment has improved and prolonged life for many, but a lot still succumb to secondary cancers later on. Fortunately, there are more survivors who live longer.
The story is really changing. Michael McKenzie, thank you.
Thank you.
You're on Life Matters on RN.